The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Prophecies Fulfilled, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Chaim Yitzchak ben Eliyahu v'Lea Bashlomo Leib, Aleihem HaSholom, Mr. and Mrs. Hyman and Leah Safran of blessed memory.
In the spring of the year 67, the general and soon to be named emperor Vespasian began a campaign that lasted some 3 years. In the aftermath of the campaign, Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, was totally destroyed. The Beis Hamikdash, the temple, was burned to the ground. Countless cities in Galilee and Judea were no more. According to Josephus' estimate, there were well over 1 million people, Jews, killed. Some 100,000 taken captive. And a few months after his victory, he led a triumphal procession winding through the streets of Rome, taking 700 of the most handsome of the Jewish captives for display. In addition, he took through with this triumphal procession the menorah, which we know is displayed in the Arch of Titus. He took a Sefer Torah. He took the gilded table, the shulchan, which was in the sanctuary. Imagine two Romans watching the display, watching this procession that's winding through the streets. You can imagine the clamor and the festivities, the victorious Romans. And one says to the other, "You know what? You see the city Rome? One day it's going to be in ruins." And the language that we're speaking, Latin, will only be a language for scholars. And those Jews, their land has been destroyed and they've been displaced, one day go back to their land, Hebrew will be a living language, and they'll rebuild Yerushalayim. In all probability, the other Roman looking at him would probably say, "This would be sugar. You're crazy." No, he said it in Latin.
How do you say that in Latin?
The truth, though, is that our history defies normal prediction. As Rabbi Chapnik quoted before, the Medrash, beginning of Bereishis Rabbah, so it's the first passage of the Medrash, states that God used the Torah as the blueprint for creation. But it's not only the blueprint, the building blocks for the creation itself, but it also is the plan for its subsequent history. I hope all of you have handouts. And I would like to go through the primary sources as to see that our survival is not in question. We know today there are all kinds of dire predictions about the survival of Jewry. We know about the intermarriage rate. The tragedy is enormous. The loss, the potential loss of millions of Jews. But our survival is not a question. The first promise the first prediction that we will survive. Here I am, paragraph A in section 1 on page 1. It's through the covenant, is the bris, the covenant of the circumcision. And this was a covenant between me, God, you and your descendants throughout their generations, an eternal covenant to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. There was a covenant, God will always be with us. And even in the worst times, where the Torah already is foreseeing all the tragedies that will befall the Jews, in paragraph B, which is taken from the Teshuva, which is taken from the curses of the Torah, the rebuke of the Torah. Yet even so, even while you're in the enemy's lands, I will not reject or spurn them, lest by wiping them out I will make void my covenant with them, for I am their God. The covenant guarantees that God will be with us. In actuality, let's say, this is a notion that we say every Passover. This is in the bottom of the paragraph G. V'hi shiyom delav osenu v'lono. We lift up the coast, lift up the cup of wine. And this, as the commentaries explain, the covenant, the unique relationship that God had with Abraham, stood by us, for our fathers and us. Every generation they try to destroy us, but God saves us. It's the covenant. There's a promise. It's not negotiable. It's a promise not only of our physical survival, but our spiritual survival as well. In paragraph C, we quote from a verse which is said in the davening, in the morning davening, prayers in 7 morning every day. My spirit which rests upon you, and my words which I put in your mouth, shall not depart from your mouth, nor from the mouths of your children, nor from the mouths of your children's children, says God, from now on to all eternity. There's a covenant that we will always, at least some of us, will always not only adhere physically to the Torah, but we will be experts in the Torah. The words of the Torah will flow from our mouths. You know, just as an interesting sideline, near the place where the Romans had their camp to surround the city and destroy it, now is full of yeshivas. The Romans are gone, but the place now is occupied by yeshivas. And perhaps some of you are acquainted with this quote. I'd like to read it with you because it's so beautiful. It's on page 2. This is a quote from Mark Twain. If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. Today it's much less than 1%. 30%. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He's as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning were also way out of proportion to the weakness in numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all the ages. He has done it with his hands tied behind his back. He could be vain of himself and excused of it for it. The Egyptian, Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff, then passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch now or vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence nor infirmities of age, no weakness of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Of course, we could answer, our immortality is based on the covenant. That's why we are called B'nai B'ris, children of the covenant. We call ourselves that because it describes our very essence. But just as our survival has been predicted, so too our difficulties have been predicted. The Torah here in the second section here on page 2, we just quoted from some of this, just to give you the inkling. As you yourselves, this is in paragraph A, I will scatter among the nations at the point of my drawn sword, leaving your countryside desolate and your cities in ruin. According to the Ramban, according to Nachmanides, this prediction refers to the destruction centered around the first temple. The second quote here is taken from Deuteronomy, which again, according to the Ramban, according to Nachmanides, is a prediction referring to the events that will occur in the wake of the destruction of the second temple. And you will be torn from the land which you are about to occupy. This is Moses is telling the people. And God shall scatter you among all the peoples from one end of the earth to the other. And there you will serve other gods of wood and stone whom you and your forefathers had not known. It's interesting to note, Josephus quotes a Greek geographer by the name of Strabo that says that in virtually in every single country of the world you will find Jews. And this was the case then. You know, there's a wonderful true story I don't know if you've seen the book The Bamboo Cradle. It's a beautiful story. There was this fellow. The Bamboo Cradle is the story of a Jewish fellow who was doing was a Fulbright Fellowship in the Far East in China, and he found an abandoned child at a railway station. He finally adopted the child. In the process, he wanted to raise the child as a Jew.
Rabbi, yeah. Could you project a little more for those of us that don't hear that?
Okay, fine. He eventually raised the child as a Jew and became Orthodox and went back to the Far East. Again, on another Fulbright Fellowship. And he describes his travels in the Far East. And at this juncture in the book, he is visiting Thailand. And he's in a remote province in Thailand, and he knows of a general store which is off the beaten track. And he has to take, this is a story I believe, he has to first take a bus to a river, which he has to go by ferry, cross the river, then take a jeep on this road, until the road already is impassable, and he has to go by foot until he gets to the general store. He comes to the general store, and he started to wear a yarmulke already. He has his little long hair, but he has a yarmulke. And he goes into the general store, and the proprietor looks at him and says, "Was macht da yi?" How is a Jew doing? There are Jews everywhere. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about going around and speaking is that I'm often given material, fresh material, by people in the audience. At one time, someone gave me, I think it was a publication from B'nai B'rith that is no longer extant. And this publication, this issue, dealt with Jews in diaspora. And there's an Israeli who was writing the article, and he was describing his experience in Vatican Square. So he was in Vatican Square, he's watching, they're waiting for the Pope to appear on the balcony. There's it's full of foreign tourists, Italian peasants from the, you know, from the provinces. There's priests and nuns, and there are salesmen of Catholic religious items going through the crowd, you know, selling the crosses and statues. There was one particular salesman who was also selling postcards. And he was looking through the postcards, and he asked the salesman, "Do you have something which doesn't have so many churches in it?" The salesman looks at him and says, and the salesman has a big cross. "Maybe you want a postcard of Moshe Rabbeinu." He said, "I'm new Yehudi." And then takes the cross, turns it over, and there's a mug and jug. And he said, "You see all these vendors here selling these religious items? They're all Jews." He said, "You know, the non-Jews, they get so wrapped up in these religious things, you know, they have no head for business, you know? They have to be cool over here." He was a descendant of those Jews who came to Rome at the destruction of the temple. You know? One side is business, and he says the other side is mazel. But the Torah and again, it's repeated on page 3 in paragraph C, in the top. So this is taken from Yechezkel. "I shall scatter you among the nations, disperse you over foreign lands, and in the process I will destroy your impurity from you." See, there's a purpose for it. There's a purpose for undergoing all these experiences. But again, it's been predicted. There's probably no nation on earth that is so scattered as the Jews. But again, our survival is predicted, our scattering has been predicted. But also, what the desolation, the destruction that was wrought in Eretz Yisrael was also predicted. Because you have to realize, Israel was a land the Torah describes as flowing with milk and honey, the most lush of all lands. Yechezkel HaNavi, the prophet Ezekiel, referring to it, calls it Tzvi Hilachol HaRatzos. It's the most splendid. It's the splendor of all lands. It was the Shangri-La of the world was Eretz Yisrael. And yet, after the destruction, it was totally desolate. And as the on page 4 here, in paragraph B, "Hashimoisi ani es oretz, v'shomo alel evechon hayoshvim bo." So devastated while I leave the land, your very enemies who come to dwell in it will stand aghast at the sight of it. I would again like to quote from Mark Twain. This is the last paragraph here on page 4. This was Mark Twain traveled through the Mideast. And in his travels, he came to what was then Palestine. "We traversed some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with pomp of life and action. We reached Tabor safely. We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, the more rocky and bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye, that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem." Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It's a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse that has withered its field and fettered its energies. Palestine is desolate and unlovely. And why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of the deity beautify a land? Palestine is no more of this workday world. It is sacred to poetry and tradition. It is dreamland. And this is taken from from his work Innocents Abroad, describing his trip in 1867. We tend to think now that the land, so much of it has been reclaimed and is so beautiful, in our mind we tend to think of just the beauty of Israel. But it was not, in historical terms, it was not that long before that it was basically a desert. And it was a desert that lasted almost 2,000 years. We described before our survival, our dispersion, the desolation. The return is also predicted in the Torah. As the Ramban points out, that all the other prophecies, the prophecies of doom, have been fulfilled so graphically, in such detail, that we are certain that the positive predictions most certainly also come to be fulfilled. And here we have on page 5 the Haftokah, the promise of our return. And the Lord your God shall return you from your captivity and have compassion upon you, to return and gather you from among all the nations to which the Lord your God has scattered you. And the Lord your God shall bring you into the land that your fathers occupied. You occupy it again, and he will make you even more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. In the way that the return is described in Sefer Devarim, though, we could only refer to the return of Jewry in this century as only basically an incomplete fulfillment of the prophecy. That prophecy is based, I've just taken part of this verse, but the complete fulfillment of that prophecy is based on the Jews' recommitment, their reaffirmation of their faith. That unfortunately has not occurred yet. But it seems from the prophets that there will be a primary phase of return, or at least a blossoming of the land before the real return. And here on paragraph C, at the bottom of page 5. As for you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel, for their return is close at hand. In other words, before the return, there will be this, the land will be prepared. So there will be a prior stage. In fact, we quote here on top of page 6, taking from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it's out of Tesson with Aleph, it's in 98a. The Abba also said there can be no more manifest sign of redemption than this, as it is written, as for you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel, where the return is close at hand. In other words, Israel will have to go through this metamorphosis, this change from a desert to a place which will be hospitable for the ingathering of the exiles. In fact, there's a Gemara Megillah. There's a tractate Megillah, says in Yud Zayin Amud Beis in 17b, that explains in the order of the Shmonesrei, in the Shmonesrei and the Amidah, we have first we have Baruch Aleinu, and then we have Tekan B'Shefer Gadol L'Cheresenu. We ask first for the blessings of the land, and then the blowing of the shofar to gather in the exiles. The reason that order is there is based on this passage of the Talmud. Because first the land must bear its fruit, and then and only then will there be the clarion call, the shofar to gather in all the exiles. So in a certain sense, we have not seen as of yet the fulfillment of the final prophecy, the total ingathering of the exiles, but there seems to be an illusion of this intermediate stage, which we have, at least in historical terms, we have seen the deserts bloom, the swamps drain. Basically, everything is ready. We just have to do tshuva. I mean, that's really Rabbi Chop's job. I just came as a...
all my jobs.
That's right.
Not just Rabbi Chop. Thanks.
Yeah, I see sitting on the side here, you know. Just... Besides the general prophecies, there are specific historical prophecies that have been made as well. And this, the Ramban, and we're using the Ramban, and we're adding to it slightly. We're using the Ramban as the model. As we stated a little before, the prophecy in the prophecies of doom, the Teufachot, in Parshas Kisovo, in Deuteronomy, refer by and large to the events that occurred in the Second Temple. And there are specific events that are referred to in a specific order. And we find that there actually is a correlation between the events described or predicted and actual historical events. And we can follow the order here. This is on page 6, section 5, paragraph 8. Yoylech Hashem oisko v'smalkecho asher tokem olecho. Says Hashem, says, the Lord shall bring you and your king which you have set over you unto a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there shall you serve other gods of wood and stone. We just celebrated, over the last week, 2 weeks ago, we celebrated Hanukkah. Hanukkah referring to the victory of the Maccabees in Sukkot. They not only were victorious, not only did they rededicate the Beis Hamikdash, but they created a dynasty of kings. And let me just give you a quick overview of the history of the period. You're all familiar with Yehuda Maccabee, who led the forces. When Yehuda died, the miracle of Hanukkah occurred approximately in 164. Before the common era, was the sense of time. When Yehuda died, his position was taken over by his brother Yonasan. And the date was approximately the year 160. Yonasan, again, he was at the time he took over the forces, they actually were forced to retreat to the other side of the Jordan. Finally, after many years, they were able to re-enter Yerushalayim. And eventually Yonasan was killed by the enemy in approximately the year, the date's in front of me, approximately in the year 140. Before the common era. His brother Shimon took over the mantle of leadership, and he died in the year 132 before the Commodore. The terrible thing when you have it recorded is the mistakes of forever. When Shimon died, this is one generation, they're brothers, it's Yehuda, Yonas, and Shimon. When Shimon died, the leadership went over to Shimon's son, Yochanan. And Yochanan ruled until the year 104 before the Common Era. In that process, Yochanan, during toward the end of his reign, became a Tzaduki, became a Sadducee. He was left the traditions of his parents. There was a king, a son of Yochanan, lived for only 1 year, Aristobulus, and it was taken over by the brother of Aristobulus, the son of Yochanan, Yanai, Alexander Janaeus, Yanai Amelah, who was king until the year 76 before the Common Era. So we have now three generations. You know, we have the generation of Yehuda, Yonas, and Shimon, one generation, Yochanan, the next generation, Yanai, the third generation. When Yanai died, the power went to Yanai's wife, Shlomtza. And for 9 years, she led the country under the influence and guidance of the Pharisees, of the Perushim, of the rabbis. When she died, approximately the year 167, originally her firstborn Hyrcanus should have been the king. His brother Aristobulus pushed him out. So now Aristobulus has now become the king. He's the fourth generation Maccabee. Right? We started with Yehuda, Yonas, and Shimon, one generation, Yochanan, two generations, Yanai, three generations. Now Aristobulus, his son, is fourth generation. Hyrcanus, to the prodding of his advisor, Antipater, who was the father of Herod, tried to regain the throne, laid siege to Jerusalem, and finally, with the help of the Romans, was able to displace his brother Aristobulus. Aristobulus was led in chains back to Rome. And it seems this prophecy, which is referring, again, according to Nachmanides, to the events of the Second Temple, is referring to this incident. If perhaps even the idea, the king which you set upon yourself, it seems to be indicates a certain artificiality. Like he's unworthy of it. He's just, you propped him up on the throne. But he, and probably many of his entourage, are sent back to Rome. Hyrcanus, the brother who now is in power, was basically a weak person. He was given the title ethnarch, in other words, it's a minor religious title. But the real power behind the throne was his advisor, Antipater. Eventually, Herod, his son, rose to power, had Hyrcanus eventually killed, and the whole family of Maccabees killed. Herod, as well as his father Antipater, were Edomians. They came from Edom. Yochanan and Hyrcanus, this is the second generation. We said, remember, the first generation is the three brothers. Second generation is Shimon's son Yochanan. Yochanan defeated the Edomians in battle, forced them to convert. And And that's Hager Asher B'Kirbecha. This is the stranger, the language Ger, the forced converts. The strangers within your midst shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. During Herod's reign, Sigven Ashan that Tzayin Ayid. He favored the non-Jewish populace, built great cities and edifices for them. And with the exception of the Beis HaMikdash, with the exception of the temple that he built, did absolutely nothing for the Jewish populace. And only added to their poverty and put on them unbearable taxes. He and his entourage grew very high, while you, the natives, the Jews, were very low. Herod was still, even though he was a petty king, but he was a petty king under the Romans, but still Judea had a quasi-independence. Eventually, when Herod died, and for some 10 years his son Archelaus continued on in Judea, and his other sons continued on in the northern areas, Archelaus was exiled, and the Romans directly ruled Judea. And here we have on paragraph C on page 6, bottom, Bavato Sebefa, you shall serve your enemies which the Lord shall send against you in hunger and thirst and nakedness and want of all things. And he shall put a yoke of iron upon your neck until he has destroyed you. The Lord shall bring a nation against you from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose tongue you shall not understand. Aramaic was a language which was a Semitic language. Latin was not. It's interesting to note as well, again, the imagery is as fast as an eagle flies. The Romans were the only nation of antiquity whose symbol was the eagle. And finally, this is the end of this whole process described. The Hifitzu Hashem B'Cholam. God will scatter you among all people from one end of the earth to the other. And eventually we have the process comes to an end and the Jews are scattered throughout the world. It's interesting to note, the historian of Isaac Halevi makes this beautiful point. From page 7, paragraph E, the final verse of the Toitokot, the final verse dealing with the events, says, and the Lord shall bring you into Egypt again with ships, by the way whereof I spoke unto you. You shall see it no more again. You'll go back to Egypt. There you shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen, for slaves, and no man shall buy you. The Jewish historian Isaac Halevi quotes the German historian Mincer, who quotes an arcane Latin source. Evidently, it must be from some papyrus. It's not from the ancient writers. And describes the events that occurred in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba defeat. Because the Bar Kokhba revolt was really the last Jewish stand in Israel. After that, the Jews raised their head no longer in Israel. That was the last revolt. It was the last attempt of independence. It was the last time Jews minted their own coins. And when they were finally defeated, there was a boatload that was taken. It says, first, those who survived were sold as slaves and taken to the various slave markets and the slave markets of Gaza. those who were left over and not sold were taken by boat to Egypt, where they were put on the slave block. But there was such animosity of the Egyptian populace against the Jews, they attacked the slaves and killed them. They were never sold. Rabbi Zicalevi points out this is the last verse referring to the events. Amazing. Up until now, we've discussed the first section in general terms about our survival, our dispersion, the desolation of the land, and the rebuilding of the land. We've discussed the specific events that occurred during the period of the Second Temple, all predicted. I'd like to go, unless all of you are familiar with this next section, I'd like to go over with you and say, it's an amazing story. You're on page 8. Here we have in the Hebrew text the names of the 10 sons of Homer, Haman's 10 sons, that according to the Talmud of the Gemara and Megillah Tazayin on the Beis in 16b, that when we read them all together in one breath. They are, as you notice, there are, most of the letters are normal letters. There are, however, three letters that, according to tradition, are spelled, are lowercase letters, are spelled, you know, very small. In Parshan Dosa, there's the Tav. In Parmashta, there's the Shin. In Vaisosa, there's the Zayin. In addition, the Vav of Vaisosa is large. There is no Masorah. We have no tradition as to why they are supposed to be written this way. It's just the halacha is that is the way. When you write a Megillah, you're supposed to write it in this manner. A few years ago, someone pointed out an amazing coincidence here. We know of the 10 sons of Haman that were hanged. You know, actually the hanging there was not that they died by the gallows. They were actually killed on the 13th day of Adar. They were beheaded. And their bodies were hung up for demonstration. You know, on this long on the pole that Haman himself had wanted to erect. To display the dead body of Mordecai, his sons were displayed. But nonetheless, we have the idea of the hanging of the 10. These are the 10 enemies of the Jews. In the aftermath of the Nuremberg trials, in 1946, 11 men were condemned to death, to be hanged at the gallows. One of them escaped the gallows by committing suicide the night before. That was Hermann Göring. In actuality, 10 were hanged. And I'm going to like to read with you here, and this is taken from Newsweek of October 28, 1946. This is the bottom of page 8, paragraph B. Frantic prison officials determined that no other victim shall escape them. Because Göring had just committed suicide. The one shackled the 10 surviving convicts in their cells. Then in 90 minutes, in the early hours of October 16th, they followed each other to the gallows. Only Julius Streicher went without dignity. He had to be pushed across the floor, wild-eyed and screaming Heil Hitler. Mounting the steps, he cried out, "Now I go to God." He had a surprise. He stared at the witnesses facing the gallows and shouted, "Purim Fest, 1946. And this was in parentheses taken in Newsweek, Purim as a Jewish feast. This is all really important. Here again we have 10 other enemies of the Jews that were hanged. What year was this? You know it's 1946, but it's October. This actually happened on Hoshana Rabbah. It's Toph Shin Zion. Do it again. See the small? Toph Shin Zion. We call this, you know, we want to know the date. You know, you see on the Jewish in the Jewish calendars from the bookstores, and they'll say the date, you know, it's 5,700, you know, and so many. What it's saying is, you know, whatever it is now, it's 50, it's 56. It doesn't, this does not mean 56-9 has passed. This is the 5,756th year. Like the first year of creation was year one, not year zero. But it's called one as it's, we're going to discuss this further on, as it's occurring. In the non-Jewish calendar, that's the case. You know, there was the year one before the Common Era. There was one the year. Then it's a full year, and then we're beginning the second, or the third. We are 5,000 years have passed, but we are in the sixth millennium. We are in the 6,000. So if we want to think in thousands, we are in the middle of the 6,000. In terms of years, we are in the middle of the, you know, 700, and now it's 56. The Vav represents the sixth millennia. So that's where the big Vav is. Big, it's uppercase. That's millennium. So for the millennium, it's Vav. It's the 6,000. In terms of 100, that's why it's lowercase, it's Toph Shin Zion. Which was, that was the Hebrew year. Is it only a coincidence? Maybe. But it's an awfully good coincidence. But this also goes in the idea that history is really, in a sense, planned. Now, you probably all came to know what to invest in 1996, right? I can't guarantee, but we'll see, we'll see. Just hold on. No one leave until the end here. I read in a magazine an amazing approach to reconstruct this system by which the blueprint, historical blueprint of the Torah is arranged. This was a publication published by Satmar. The author was, as I recall, the Gabbai of the Kehillah in Montreal. In a kollel that we have a vast number of back issues. I could not find that issue. And I had to reconstruct the system on my own. But the system goes as follows. So I don't know who he quoted it from. It's just the coincidences are amazing. I hope you all have these things. You can take it home with you and do your own research with this. According to the Masoreh, the Masoretic text, this is the text that we use when we read the Torah. There are 5,845 verses in the Torah. So that's the number of psukim, that's the number of verses there are in the Torah. The simon is hachama, the sun. Hey is the 5,000, and the chama is the 8 is 845. According to the system, every verse corresponds to a year. Verse 1 is year 1, verse 2, year 2, etc. There is a, just to explain the difficulty with this, to pin it down, there are actually two systems of counting years. The systems that the bookstores use, the numbers you see there, and the system that is in the Seder Olam, is the historical midrash of how you calculate years. There are astronomical years and there are historical years. The historical years begin with the birth of Adam, with the creation of man. And in that, we can figure how old we can figure out examples. There's a date that many of you are familiar with that Avraham Avinu, that Abraham was born in the year 1948. I remember Rebbe and Yeshiva said this. One guy in the back tripped up. Hey, it was a post-war baby. The year 1948 is not really that accurate. The year 1948 is gotten by adding up all the years. We know that Adam lived so many years before he begot his child. And the number of years is really, it's the number of years that have passed. Like, this is how many years have gone by. That's how when you count. He was so old till he had his baby, right? And he was so old till he got his baby. So we're counting all the years that have passed. But if I want to know what year that was, right, then I have to add a year. For instance, here's an example. Adam HaRishon was 130 when he begat his child Shase, which all of mankind comes from. So if you want to know how old Adam was, he was 130. What year was it? It was 131. Because he came into the being in the year 1. And if you add 130 years to it, you get the year 131. Because it's the 131st, because when we count years, we don't count the ones that have passed, but the ones that we are in. Right. So therefore, true Shase was born when Adam was 130 years old. However, the year is year 131. That's the historical means of counting. So we can go that way when we get Avraham Avinu. Abraham is 1948. Means really the year should be 1949. I'm getting sick of the Korean War here. That's what I said. The historical dating begins with man. But the dating that we have on our bookstore calendar is the astronomical dating. In the astronomical dating, we count the first 5 days of creation as a year. In other words, in the equivalence, of course, it's not, there were no months then, but in the equivalence, the first day of creation was the 25th day of Elul. Adam HaRishon came into being the first of Tishrei. What year was that? That's how you count. You're counting astronomically, it's year 2. If you're counting historically, you need people for history, it's year 1. So So therefore, when we say that there's a correspondence to the years, these verses to the years, I am not sure which system we're using. Are we using the historical system? Are we using the astronomical system? It's give or take a year. I mean, in Lakewood, when they used to always say the dates, the times for everything. You know what I mean? Shabbos is over, Yom Tov starts. Sarach l'hachmor beis minutes. You know, there's a variance of 2 minutes. You know, there's this the uncertainty principle. In other words, you're not exactly sure which is which. So there may be a certain fuzziness over here. But taking that into account, let's proceed with the system here. Okay? What year the first temple was destroyed? Right? In the year Shelach. In other words, it was 3,338. That was the year that the first temple was destroyed. On paragraph C, on page 9, we have the verses that deal with, this is the verse before and the verse after, that deals, which comes out on that verse. So let's read this together. This is verse 3,338. You shall therefore keep all my statutes and my judgments to do them, that the land whither I bring you to dwell spit you not out. So let's keep the mitzvahs, or you'll be thrown out of the land. That's how this is supposed to be. And you shall not walk in the manners of the nation which I cast out before you, for they committed all these things, therefore I abhorred them. But I have said unto you, you shall inherit the land, and will give it unto you to possess, then the floweth with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who separated you from other people. This is the verse that says that their connection to the land is contingent with their keeping the high moral standards of the Torah. If they lower themselves, they have no right to be in the land, just like the nation that was thrown out previous. The Gemara says in Yoma, in Tesom, in Beis, in 9b, that one of the reasons the temple was destroyed was because of licentiousness, because of Gilui Arayos. This very issue. So this verse that refers to throwing out of the land is the year that the temple was destroyed and the Jews went into exile. What about the year that the second temple was destroyed? For this is a shtickle failure, because it's not so simple, but it's an interesting shtickle failure. There's a very interesting structure to this. Let's read the verses that have to do with the years of the destruction of the second temple. It refers to the Nazarite vow. And the year that comes the ultimate destruction, he can't come in contact with a dead body, he can't cut his hair. And if any man, this is it's underlined here, die very suddenly by him, he had defiled the head of his consecration. And if someone dies, someone suddenly dies, then he's finished. It's a pasuk that deals with death. But more so, there's an incident which was recorded in the Talmud, very interesting, which has to do with Nazarites and the destruction of the Second Temple. And on top of page 10, there was a group of Nazirim, of Nazarites, who, if one is a Nazir, if one is a Nazirite, one is bound by the oath of being a Nazirite, to keep him not to cut the hair, or to drink wine, or come in contact with the dead, until he brings his sacrifices in the temple. If theoretically, if a person never brings a sacrifice, then his vow is still binding. There was an incident, there was a large group of Nazarites who were uninformed about the destruction of the temple. They came to Jerusalem to complete their vow, and they were stuck. This is a Gemara in Nozer, along with Beis on Beis on 32b. When the Nazarites arrived in Jerusalem from the diaspora and found the temple in ruins, Nochem HaModi said to them, he was one of the scholars of the time, that he found that he annulled their vow. And others took issue with this. That you can't be, that since it's something that was unanticipated, you can't annul, there's not basis for an annulment. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean it's unanticipated? The destruction of the second temple was foretold a long time before. In the prophecy of Daniel, the prophet, at least how the Talmud interprets this, there will be a period of 490 years between the destruction of the first temple and the second temple. And according to the traditional dating system, there's 490 years between the two events. And that's the dating system the Talmud used. She says it's predictable. So the Gemara answers, yes, the event was generally predictable, but it's not clear which day. In other words, in theory, they still came in the year and they could have had time, and it was something which was far from a certainty which day would the temple be destroyed. But one thing we see clearly, that the destruction of the temple is associated with the Nazarite vow. I mean, enough that a section of the Talmud is devoted to it. Just interesting that that year is the year of, as we refer, is the parsha, is the portion dealing with the Nazir. Let's go a little further in history, the expulsion from Spain. We know that the expulsion from Spain has a special significance in that it fell out on Tisha B'Av. Now, the expulsion was on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a date which is associated with all kinds of tragedies. I'd like to, before we get into this pasuk here, I'd like to give you just a little background of Spain before the expulsion. The Spain of 1492 was not the Spain of the Rambam. There were probably more, I'm not sure, but there were probably more Jews that were apostate Jews than were actually practicing Jews. And there are many Jews who were apostates by choice. The Sefer Akedas Yitzchak deals with a very interesting problem that was common to the communities in Spain. He speaks about it in Parshas Vayera, in the Parsha of Sodom, Vamora, and Lot. And he tells over that there were communities in Spain that wanted to legalize prostitution. And the reason they wanted to do so was because they felt that there were young men who were having affairs with married women and they needed an outlet. And they make it kosher, the glot kosher. The prostitutes would go to the mikveh and it would be supervised and there would be checked for health. You know what I mean? I don't know if they put an OU, I don't know what slumber they would put on it, but it would be glot kosher. And he writes there, the Akedas Yitzchak Chas V'Sholom, his individuals could go off, but we can't lower the level of the whole community to prevent individuals from going away. The sanctity of the community has to remain intact. You know, just by the way, there's a similar thought that has to do with the story of Pinchas and Zimri. You're familiar with the story of Pinchas, when the Jews camped near a place called Shittim, The populace went to purchase items from the local, from the salespeople, the women there. They were induced to commit acts of involved with prostitutes at the cost, but they were induced as well to worship idols in the process. Is because they were worshiping idols, there was a mass prosecution of the violators. Thousands were put to death. And the tribe of Shimon came to one of their leaders, Zimri, and he says, "Kulonu Mason, we're all dying." And it was because of this. Do something. And what did he do? He brought Cosmi Basur, he brought this woman into the camp, and in public had relations with her. What did he want to accomplish? He said, "We're all dying," and he's bringing. What did he want to accomplish? From Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, really, if you quote it from the name of the Sam Sofa, he wanted to explain as follows. Their problem was they wanted to have relations with these non-Jewish women. But since they were having relations outside the camp, they were lured into worshiping idols. So there's no control. So he says, bring the prostitutes into the camp. You know, they'll be checked, you know what I mean? They'll metal detectors. There'll be no avodah zarah. And they'll be brought in. So no, they won't be killed. In other words, those people who want to have the relations won't be tempted into worshiping idols. You have to worshiping idols is a capital offense. At this Pinchas, this is the godless of Pinchas, he went, he risked his life, and he killed Zimri. Because what he was doing, what Zimri was doing, was saving individuals at the cost of the very fiber, the sanctity of the community itself. Because by sanctioning prostitution, this is Boel Aramis, so he just lowered the whole Kedusha of Klal Yisrael. The whole sanctity was lowered. But these were the issues that were involved in pre-expulsion Spain. Let's read the pasuk that has to do, which comes out to that pasuk, which is 1492. This is verse 5252. And it says, if a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall be both of them die, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman, uviyarta haro miyisrael, so she'll put away evil from Israel. This was the pasuk, this was the verse of the expulsion. Let's go to something closer in history. World War II. These are the psukim here, the bottom of page 10, which correspond with World War II and the Holocaust. V'yicharach Hashem boretz ahi, in the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land to bring upon it all the curse that is written in this book. That's 1939. And the Lord rooted them out of their land in anger and in wrath and great indignation and cast them to another land as it is to this day. This is 1940. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us, to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. In other words, this is the verse which we are commanded to we are commanded to deal with those who to bring judicial action against those who violate the law. It shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessings and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them into mind among all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath driven thee. And I shall return unto the Lord thy God and shall obey his voice. And then, this last pasuk is 1945. Then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity after passion upon thee, and return and gather thee from all the nations whither the Lord thy God has scattered thee. These are the verses which correlate, which correspond to the Holocaust. Let's see, what verse corresponds to the establishment of the state of Israel? These are the verses that refer to the return. U'mol Hashem lokechos levoch, from the Lord thy God shall circumcise thine heart, the heart of thy seed, to love the Lord thy God with all your heart and all your soul, that you might live. And the next part, which is the victory, and the Lord thy God shall put all the curses upon thine enemies and on them that hate thee, which persecute thee. Because this is the verse which corresponds to the victory against the Arab League. What about the Six-Day War? Neson Hashem lefnechem v'asisam lehem is referring to the enemies. The Lord shall give them upon before your face, and you may do unto them according to all the commandments which I have commanded you. This is about taking retribution against the enemy. I gave this class, this was the year, right before 1994. 1994-95 was Kishem Hashem Ekro Havogodya. This was the, when I call to the name of the Lord, ascribe ye greatness unto our God. In other words, when you are given the opportunity, respond, be involved. The verse following, which is our year, is Hatsur Tomim Pa'ala, Behold the Rock of Mishpat. It's referring to a time that we will be chastised. It is a time where we will be punished, and yet we issue the statement that God is just. That is, Tov Shin Nun Vav is the year that Rabin was assassinated, that the Golan now is going to be brought back, that many of these cities that were occupied, formerly occupied the Israelis, have given them back to the Arabs. This is a process that will be going on throughout this year. That's 1996. Sorry, I couldn't tell you about technology stocks. I'd like to end with something which I think is appropriate to this time. We just finished the fast of Asar B'Teves, and I'd like to share with you a feeling, an idea that I have. We know that there are four fast days associated with the destruction of the first temple. The tenth day of Teves being historically the first day when Nebuchadnezzar, Soma, who came close, launched his campaign to surround Jerusalem. In Tammuz, the walls were breached. He took charge of Yerushalayim. In Av, the Beis Hamikdash was burned. And in Tishrei, third of Tishrei, Gedaliah ben Achikam, who was the tzaddik, who was the saintly governor of the Jews, placed by the Babylonians, was assassinated. And in the aftermath of his assassination, all the Jews who were in Israel fled, never to return for another 52 years. The last three events in Tammuz, the breaching of the wall, in Av, the burning of the temple, and in Tishrei, the assassination, are all associated with destruction, catastrophe, loss of life. Asar B'Teves, the tenth day of Teves, Nothing happened. Just the enemy drew close. Well, they could go away, you know. And why have such a fast day on something that really didn't have true historical significance? Which makes a thing even more complicated is the fact that it's brought in halacha that if theoretically Asura v'Teves would fall out on Shabbos, and according to our calendar, which is fixed already from the year 359, Asura, the 10th of Teves, cannot fall out on Shabbos. But before that, when the calendar was much more flexible, it could have fallen out on Shabbos. We know when any of the other fast days fall out on Shabbos, they're pushed ahead a day. Asura v'Teves, according to this opinion, the Kobo is not. You fast on Shabbos. So in a certain sense, Asura v'Teves, the 10th of Teves, is much more severe, much more stringent than the other fast days. Okay, there's a pasuk that is derived from it that uses as Be'atzim Hayom Hazeh, that the surrounding of Jerusalem occurred on that very same day. It gives expression on the 10th of Teves. It's the same expression which is used to express on Yom Kippur that you fast. Be'atzim Hayom Hazeh. We know on Yom Kippur you fast even falls out on Shabbos. That's a derivation. But what's the theory behind it? Why should it be so? And it seems to me that it's telling us a very, very profound message. Something which we should take to heart, especially in light of the present historical events. Historically, there was another event that preceded the surrounding, Nebuchadnezzar's army surrounded Jerusalem, a similar event, over 100 years before. And that's when Sanherib, which is the king of the Assyrians, surrounded Yerushalayim. That time Hizkiah was the king. And in his reign, in anticipation of the siege, he embarked on a whole new course of a renaissance of Jewish education. To the extent, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin says that there was the Tzadik Dalal on the base in 94b, they checked from one end of Israel to from the top to the bottom. There wasn't a child that wasn't familiar in the most difficult halachas, the Negoyim, the Olas, the most difficult laws pertaining to the ritual purity. And it was because of that, their new dedication to learning. The schus, the merit of this, was able that they were able to withstand the siege of the Assyrians, and there was a miracle that occurred on the night of Passover, and the whole army of Sanherib was destroyed. What did Sitzkiyahu, the king now, at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, on Asura v'Teves, what plan of action did he embark upon to save the Jews? And it seems what he did was he beefed up his defenses. He had an alliance with the Egyptians. He relied on his military strategy, on his defenses, on he would withstand the siege. Very unlike the procedures that Hizkiah, his ancestor, had taken. You know, there's a medrash in the beginning of the Psichta of Eicha Rabosi, in the introduction to Eicha, that tells the story that Rabbi Elazar sent Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi to go through the cities of to see the state, the educational state of the cities in Israel. They came to a city, and he asked them, show me the Neturei Karta, the guardians of the city. And he showed them the police force, the militia. He says, these aren't the guardians of the city. Hey, Machrive Karta, they're the destroyers of the city. The Neturei Karta, the garden of the city are the kids that are studying. Or the Tinoka Shabbos Rabba. Those are the guardians of the city. It's through their schus, through their merit, that the city will be saved. The tragedy of Asura Bateves is that they heard the warning. They saw the Babylonians at the wall, and they didn't do tshuva. They didn't change. They didn't declare fast days. They didn't do soul searching. They didn't make a whole new commitment in their lives. They let things be as they always were and relied on normative military measures to protect them. We know the rest is history. The other three fast days that we commemorate represent the actual destruction. But the tragedy that we didn't listen to the message, we didn't hear the clarion call, is of such magnitude that even if it falls out on Shabbos, we don't push it away. We fast. It's that day. The day when the Babylonians came to the wall, we have to act. We don't push it off after Shabbos. When we hear it, we act. When we conquered in 67 all those lands, there was such great enthusiasm. We're hoping this is the beginning of the final stages of Mashiach. We're living now in an age when that land is being given back. And the security of the Jews, not only those, the settlers, but Jews throughout Israel, has already been is much more precarious than it ever was. Even in this country, we don't know, we're blessed with tremendous wealth, unprecedented in history. But on the other hand, we're standing by when the majority of our brethren are being assimilated, are intermarrying, are cut off from the corpus of Paul Yisrael. And I think it's appropriate, on one hand, there's a realization of God's hand in history. And that's the pasuk, is it for this year. Atzur Tom and Polo. But on the other hand, it's a reminder to us to hold the rock of Mishpat, that when we suffer, it's a punishment. And if we could change, possibly, the outcome would be possibly very, very different. We can't, I don't think any of us has the power to change the world. But we can change ourselves and perhaps a few of the people around us. We make a little wave, another person makes a little wave. Hopefully, the combination of all these vibrations and waves will make great changes. Okay, any questions? Only one.
You mentioned there's 5,845
verses in
the Torah
that correspond,
and
they
have.
There's a theory. I mean,
does this, can one extrapolate that this is the end, the case? You know, that's the.
I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. Okay.
Just thinking of the very negative, or let's say.
It would seem if this theory is right.
Be a very interesting. What can the Jew do
to help this change, make this change, because we have the power, if we would follow, in general, we know we just on general terms have to make changes in our lives, and we know that we have responsibility to affect to the extent that we can the world around us. But if we would focus in specifically on this verse, right? You know, just we spoke on this verse itself. basically, it would seem it's telling us a message in betochen, in trust in God. There is a tendency, and this was the tendency of the one who assassinated Rabin. There's a tendency of, we can't let this happen. We are going to change things. You know, it's we are going to do radical things. You know, to change the tide of history. I think there first has to be a realization that no matter what happens to the Jewish people, the covenant between us and God still exists. And we shouldn't panic. In other words, you know, it's not, everything is part of a plan. And that's his actions are pure. They may be their mishpat, their response to our shortcomings. But on the other hand, I think that there's a demand on our thing of a certain, an awareness of his presence in history. This pasuk is basically saying, you know, if we're reading this correctly, that God is in charge. It's mishpat. It's because that something that happens is happening because of a shortcoming on our part. But on the other hand, he is in charge. So, and because there is this thing of mishpat, that means that if I change my actions, then the mishpat will be different.
Do you feel part of that mishpat is regarding Achdus and how we're dealing with each other as Jews and brothers or sisters?
It's very, very well taken. But it's, you know, when you deal with when you're dealing with issues, and I feel that when you're dealing with issues, you know, we have a problem of sinas chinam. We have a problem of there's tremendous divisions within the Jewish community. You won't, sitting here or are talking about it, I doubt will make a major dent in the way they will conduct their lives. I think what we have to do is I think the thing is what we have to do is we here have to conduct our lives in a better way, and perhaps the vibrations that are set in motion will change things over there. There's a very interesting thought by Yisrael Salanter that he was speaking to his students who were in Kovno. Kovno, Lithuania, which was a major center of Torah. And he told them, says, about wasting their time, you know, not taking advantage of the time that's given, wasting their time. Because as mevatel dawn Kovno, when we waste our time and don't spend our time learning Torah, which we have the opportunity and training, if we waste our time here, in Paris, where a Jew is marginally holding on to his, you know, to his Jewishness, to his identity, very tenuously. And he may be toying with the fact, should he convert to Christianity and be accepted in non-Jewish society, or should he keep his Jewishness? And it's a real issue for him. And when you're cooled off there in Kovno, it makes ripples that marginal Jew in Paris loses his sense of Jewishness, and he becomes an apostate.
as Mabatul Doran called Nashmat Menoch in Paris. If one does not grow spiritually in Lithuanian Kovna, it will have an effect in Paris that a Marja will already convert to Christianity. I think what we have to do is create ripples within our own selves and our own community. I don't think we can go and like point fingers, you know, you're not nice enough over there.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.